Unlike oil and gas projects, these incinerators can be built wherever there is plastic waste, but burning plastic can produce multiple dangerous toxins. Along with other agencies, EPA has announced that most staff will return to in-person work 5 days a week, which the new administration says will push personnel to quit. And the Department of Government Efficiency, led by billionaire Elon Musk, has gained access to the EPA's acquisition system, controlling millions in spending. In line with White House moves on diversity programs, the new administration looks likely to dismantle the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice, putting the staff on leave. Adrian Hollis with the National Wildlife Federation says the office was created by President George H.W. Bush to protect minority and low-income communities. She says eliminating it will hit vulnerable communities hardest.
The Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights focuses on issues that affect communities and groups of people that are disproportionately impacted by environmental issues or disproportionately impacted when rules and regulations are not followed.
Federal judges have blocked several key administration policies on government reform and immigration. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt called these rulings a continuation of the weaponization of justice against President Donald Trump. Advocates warn that national monuments in western states, including Bears Ears, Devil's Tower, and Grand Staircase Escalante, are at risk from expanding energy production. Daniel Hart with the National Parks Conservation Association says Americans have repeatedly spoken out in defense of them.
They support the outdoor recreation economy, especially in rural states. Those communities nearby are heavily supported by the people who come in and out of these national monuments.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has confirmed former Democratic Representative Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence, a major win for President Trump. Gabbard's nomination sparked controversy over her past positions on Ukraine and government surveillance, and her 2017 meeting with former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And in Ohio, a contentious bill is drawing backlash from university students and faculty. Supporters say Senate Bill 1 would ensure political balance in public college classrooms by restricting diversity-related programs and requiring what they call neutrality when teaching controversial topics. Clara Conover with the Ohio Student Association says it would mandate the teaching of right-wing ideology. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 13th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Farah Siddiqui and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are the week's top stories. Closing down the Agency for International Development will cause widespread harm. Designating cartels as terrorist organizations may backfire. And Chinese companies help North Korea evade sanctions. First, closing down AID will cause widespread harm. Reaction to the Trump-Musk assault on government has finally come. In the courts, among the halts to Trump's executive orders are those concerning citizenship by birth, keeping secret the names of FBI personnel who worked on the January 6 insurrection, and putting roughly 10,000 USAID workers on leave. Closure of USAID has been suspended by court order, thanks to legal actions of the American Foreign Service Association and the American Federation of Government Employees, who cite irreparable harm to employees and to U.S. national security. Elon Musk has attacked aid as being a criminal enterprise and has bragged about feeding it to the wood chipper. Trump is now saying that corruption at USAID is at levels rarely seen before. Close it down. His only evidence is the absurd story of $50 million being spent by AID on condoms for Gazans. As a result, AID workers are returning home, vital life-saving health care has been suspended, and great harm is being done to farmers at home as well as abroad. There is little alarm in the United States, perhaps because foreign aid has never been popular, either in Congress or among the public. The impact of the shutdown on the U.S. agricultural community has not been highlighted enough. First, it cuts $2 billion straight out of U.S. farmers' pockets from the Food for Peace program, which purchases surplus rice, wheat, corn, and soy from U.S. farmers, distributes them to food-poor countries. In some states, and for some crops, USAID was their primary buyer. Second, agricultural research is also affected. Kansas State University, for instance, lost up to $50 million that was pledged through a USAID program over the next 5 years to advance research in sustainable intensification, an approach focused on increasing crop yields without expanding agricultural land use. The program was expected to directly benefit Kansas and other U.S. farmers. Of course, the most severe impact on U.S. farmers will come from Trump's tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China, all major buyers of U.S. agricultural exports. Susan Glasser writes in The New Yorker that the real aim of Trump and Musk isn't the relatively small USAID budget. They are killing one agency to terrify 1,000 others, she writes. Rather than trim budgets or reduce programs, they want to eliminate whole departments and agencies. And not a single Republican is rising up to stop this. Glasser cites a tape recording obtained by ProPublica of a statement by the Project 25's Russell Vaught, who has just been confirmed for director of the powerful Office of Management and Budget. Vaught said, quote, "When they," meaning government bureaucrats, "wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work. We want to put them in trauma." Next, designating cartels as terrorist organizations may backfire. If a criminal group abroad uses U.S.-made computers in its work, is the U.S. manufacturer guilty of terrorism? That, in a nutshell, is the problem many U.S. companies face now that the Trump administration has issued an executive order designating Mexican drug cartels as terrorist groups. Trump's idea is that the order will put more pressure on Mexico to rein in drug traffickers. But as the New York Times explains, quote, "The cartels have extended their operations far beyond drug trafficking and human smuggling. They are now embedded in a wide swath of the legal economy, from avocado farming to the country's billion-dollar tourism industry, making it hard to be absolutely sure that American companies are isolated from cartel activities," unquote. If a U.S. company gets caught up in a cartel's operations, it would be subject to sanctions, seizure of assets, and other even more severe penalties. There are so many ways that a company or individuals can become ensnared in activities run by a cartel. Employees of companies bankrolled by a cartel may actually be on the payroll of a cartel without knowing it. Banks may wire money to a business that in fact is run by a cartel. Importers of avocados may be at particularly high risk as cartels have expanded into that sector. A former U.S. official who has dealt with this issue says that the use of a terrorism label has been on the table in previous administrations but was ultimately rejected because, quote, "Such a designation would actually be super short-sighted and ill-considered, though prior administrations viewed the U.S.-Mexico relationship far differently than the incoming Trump administration appears to. Some U.S. companies may be looking elsewhere to continue their operations." Chinese companies help North Korea evade sanctions on military assistance. Two recent studies have shown China's lack of compliance with United Nations sanctions on North Korea. Since a Russian veto in March 2024 ended the tenure of the UN panel of experts, there is no clear global institutional mechanism to deal with sanctions compliance. Some Chinese companies have evaded the sanctions simply by looking the other way when it ships goods to North Korea or facilitates North Korean access to vital weapons ingredients. One study of Chinese machine tools exports indicates that China has not exercised due diligence to locate the machine tools, identify the actual end user, or confirm that the machine tools were not shipped onwards to North Korea. A Chinese investigation agreed that the machine tools ended up in North Korea, but was unwilling to cooperate with foreign criminal prosecutions. The other study of North Korean access to uranium in Namibia via Chinese-controlled mines shows how sanctions are undercut in another way, via Chinese economic ties with a developing country, one that, in this case, has been a vital ingredient in North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In other news, Massachusetts Institute of Technology shuts down a database over research on Israel. MIT has been caught up in the same kind of drama that some universities faced during the Vietnam War, accepting research money that might be used to support military operations, in this case, Israel's. Pro-Palestinian groups, whose activities MIT administration has tried to restrict, gained access to the university's internal grant tracking software to obtain details about projects that have received Israeli military funding. Among the projects were partnerships to research underwater surveillance, missile detection, and drone algorithms. The funding by Israel's defense ministry came to $3.7 million. The U.S. Defense Department also contributed funds to these projects. MIT has closed access to the database and defended the research being done by professors. The university president condemned, quote, harassment, intimidation, and targeting of specific professors and their research, but said nothing about the ethics of supporting a foreign military establishment that many have found guilty of genocide. In Africa, Rwanda has invaded eastern Congo. This week, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group claimed it had captured the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and has been advancing southward in its offensive. The seizure comes after years of a simmering conflict in eastern Congo, which international officials have accused Rwandan President Paul Kagame of fueling, an allegation he denies. The rebels are mostly ethnic Tutsi, just as is Kagame. Michelle Arong, who has written extensively about the M23 group, says that contrary to Kagame's claim that militias across the border threaten Rwanda security, quote, Rwanda's unacknowledged exploits in Congo have long since ceased to be about self-defense or even revenge. They are intended instead to assert hegemonic dominance over Rwanda's neighbors and guarantee access to the natural resources of a vast region, unquote. In a recent interview, she added, quote, the M23 has been Kagame's way of reminding people that he sees himself as a key player, and that if he isn't taken into account and included in the various deals, he can make life very, very difficult for the residents of the Great Lakes region. Two African organizations, the East African Community and Southern African Development Community, convened a brief joint summit in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, on February 8th, as the conflict escalated. Tanzania's president warned, quote, for the last couple of weeks, we have witnessed the spread of violence that has caused massive harm to human life, massive displacement and insecurity, which affected economic activities and disrupted cross-border trade, unquote. She said history will judge those who failed to bring the conflict to an end. Next, two items on Trump's deportations. The first involves housing deportees at Guantanamo Bay. Donald Trump has the harebrained idea to house 30,000 deported migrants in the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Most people don't even know that we have 30,000 beds in Guantanamo to detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people, he said. Well, we don't. According to military people who are familiar with Gitmo, it currently can only house 700. Creating a 30,000-person facility, which would be 200 times the size of Leavenworth military prison, would take years, require an enormous guard force. Leavenworth has one guard for every three prisoners, and thus require lots of money. Stupid is as stupid does. Then there are the Indian deportees sent home in shackles as Prime Minister Modi prepares to visit the U.S. Another embarrassing moment for the Trump administration. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi will visit the U.S. for talks with President Trump on trade and other issues days after 104 Indians were deported in shackles on a U.S. military plane, with more to come, perhaps as many as 500 more. The U.S. is India's top trading partner. So, as usual, Trump has the edge in threatening higher tariffs on Indian goods. Modi will be hard put to challenge the deportations. In all, by the way, there are said to be 1.7 million Asian immigrants in the U.S. illegally and subject to deportation. Trump sanctions the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Republicans have always detested international organizations whose authority touches upon Americans, and especially U.S. troops engaged in combat abroad. Now Donald Trump is continuing that tradition by issuing an executive order that places economic and travel sanctions on any ICC official who conducts investigations into U.S. citizens and allies. The U.S. is not a member of the ICC, but nevertheless, Trump's order directs Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, in consultation with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to submit a report within 60 days naming people who should be sanctioned. Reuters reports that the first target of the order will be the British jurist Karim Khan, who prosecuted the cases that resulted in war crimes charges against Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Gallant. So now, Trump has demonstrated his loyalty to them, as well as followed up on his accusation that the ICC abuses its power. Actually, it is Trump who has abused his power and revealed once again his disrespect for the rule of law. The ICC acts under international treaty, ratified by 125 countries, to convict people like Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin who have committed war crimes. The ICC issued a condemnation of Trump's order. It pledged to stand by its staff and, quote, continue providing justice and hope to millions of innocent victims of atrocities across the world in all situations before it. The Baltic states will disconnect from Russia's electricity grid. Reuters reports that the Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, are bracing themselves for possible sabotage and cyber attacks as they complete their long-awaited decoupling from Russia's power grid. The Baltic states are due to fully disconnect from the Moscow-controlled BRELL energy network before completing their connection to the European electricity system. This is a major development inasmuch as the three states have long been tied to a system that includes Belarus as well as Russia. The head of Estonia's cybersecurity office said, quote, thanks to strong national and international cooperation, Estonia is well prepared even for worst-case scenarios, though this does not mean such threats will materialize. And one final item, Trump's Middle East envoy is aghast at the devastation in Gaza. Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, visited Gaza recently and returned to Washington with a dire impression of the devastation he witnessed, conveying to Trump and later to reporters a view that it was no longer habitable. It is the buildings that could tip over at any moment, he said. There's no utilities there whatsoever. No working water, electric, gas, nothing. God knows what kind of disease might be festering there, he said. He never paused to reflect on why that happened, who was responsible, or how Gaza might be reconstructed. Instead, he gave impetus to Trump's plan for developing Gaza, that is, by removing the entire Palestinian population, turning Gaza into a new Riviera, and profiting from the hotels Jared Kushner will help build. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Could climate change upend the American dream? New research by the First Street Foundation is pointing to widespread and systemic economic risk from a climate-driven decline in property values. The new report details the vulnerability of the $50 trillion residential real estate market in the U.S. It projects huge losses to homeowners across the country starting this year. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten about the report and its implications for the future.
So climate change and the American dream, what could they possibly have to do with each other?
Well, the American dream, you know, the cliche of it is that we're going to all, build enough wealth and own our own homes one day, and that those homes will appreciate and be our main pool of asset savings, as they have been for the last 20 years before us. And climate change is making life more expensive and those homes more tenuous and their value quite uncertain.
Don't homes kind of go up and down in terms of value? I mean, is it always a steady upward swing? I mean, aren't there times when the bubble bursts and the homes are not worth so much, regardless of climate change?
Yeah, of course. It's a fluctuating circumstance. But over the last 20 years, I think the report that I reported on this week from First Street says that homes have appreciated on average about 58% over the last 20 years. So it's been that the overall trend line, like the stock market, has been of increasing value over a long period of time.
So would you say it's better, or in the next 30-year period that you're talking about, it would be better to be a renter?
Well, I think that it depends on where you are and what your circumstances are. The report that I wrote about this week suggests that on average across the country over the next 30 years, property values, residential property values, will decrease by 6%. That doesn't mean that they won't climb in certain places, but according to their models, in 85% of U.S. census tracts, that will be the predominant trajectory. Now, of course, that's one outfit's guess based on some pretty advanced scientific modeling, but they could be wrong as well. I mean, nobody knows exactly what will happen with prices.
So meanwhile, we have these wildfires and these extreme weather conditions, and people are likely to move away and migrate somewhere else. So how significant will that be? I mean, how many people are we talking about?
I wrote a book about climate-driven migration in the United States called On the Move. And it goes into this question in enormous detail. But suffice to say, there's no clear answer for, the question of how many. It could be 15 million Americans. It could be 160 million Americans. Either of those numbers are just enormous, would transform the demographics of this country and the geography of our cities. But, it is fairly certain that climate pressures will change where people live in this country. Won't universally evacuate certain parts of the country, but it will tend to push people out of rural areas and into cities, and it will tend to push people towards relatively safer zones in the northern and northeastern part of the country. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic in terms of property values. It's, very much in flux. One of the reasons that property values might begin to decrease is because the cost of owning property is increasing with climate change. The cost of insurance in particular are skyrocketing. Now, of course, as people move away, if people do move out of a community, then that's the opposite kind of pressure on those property values. And if there is decreased demand, then that could lower property, or that could increase. If there is decreased demand, then that could lower property values as well. So there's a lot in flux here, but moving populations across the United States will dramatically change the country.
Is this something that's being talked about much in the real estate industry?
Yeah, absolutely. You see increasing reports from companies like Zillow and Redfin tracking the sentiments of people who use their services, of real estate buyers. There's a large percentage of Americans over the last 4 or 5 years who have said that climate change and fears of disasters are a major factor in them deciding where to move to and in whether or not to buy or sell their homes.
Now, some people have thought that the American dream was dead decades ago, but do you think that it's still alive in people's minds?
I mean, there's a lot of ways to define the American dream, and by some measures, I think we could have a robust conversation about whether it's been alive or dead. I think, the main point here is to start to look at the ways that climate pressures are going to manifest in economic ways, that they're going to be costly for Americans and for the United States as a government and as a society. And one of the ways we're going to start to see that is in, at least, the instability that it causes in the value of assets like homes. And then, perhaps as this report I wrote about forecasts, the drop in value of homes.
So this could lead to some political action, do you think, to deal with climate change in a more serious way?
I mean, I think that that's a logical response, but it also should have been a logical response for many years now. I mean, as I wrote in my book, and I've got a whole chapter on the rising cost of insurance in the insurance industry, the residential insurance market has already been responding to climate change for 30 years, since 1992 and Hurricane Andrew in Florida. And the problems that we're seeing today are making headlines and they're getting more significant, but they're not altogether different from the challenges of 1992. And so far, the, you know, the policy and political response to insurance rates in particular has been, you know, to subsidize costs, to protect the economy, and more or less ignore climate change and the risks of it. And the bigger question about policy and climate change, I mean, we're decades behind in having effective policy. We haven't seen very much effective policy except for, you know, some of the laws passed over the last 4 years. And I'm skeptical that, you know, much will shake those policies loose in the near future.
So can anything be done at the state level? I guess that's where the insurance legislation would come from, right? Could that be a mitigating factor?
I mean, there's lots of opportunities, you know, at the state level. Insurance will need to be fairly priced in order to be preserved. And the preservation of insurance is more or less essential to our economy and to, you know, protecting the assets of homeowners or anybody that owns property. So insurance has been systematically underpriced relative to its climate risks across the country for a long time. And so part of what needs to happen at a minimum is that states need to allow insurers to charge what they need to charge in order to actually provide the coverage that we want from them. So it's one, you know, one policy outcome. States will have a lot of opportunity to address this in a lot of different ways. And you're seeing California, you know, begin to do that in some ways. I think zoning and development questions are, you know, are really key. Do you continue to allow development into high-risk areas that are not already developed? You know, wildfire interfaces in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, for example. I think the answer should be no. Do you rebuild in extremely vulnerable places is a much more complicated question, and I think will take, you know, a little bit of deft planning. And probably the responsible answer is a mixture of creating buffer zones and buying out certain properties, but allowing others to be rebuilt in the smartest possible way with proper building materials that can go a long way towards protecting people from fire risk in the future.
What you said about insurance, that it's actually underpriced right now, I'm thinking that if the insurance rates go up anymore, this is going to be yet another burden on homeowners who already, well, at least in California, have to pay property taxes. And what will that do to home ownership? I mean, it just seems like more of a burden.
It is, and it will be. And that's the nature of the story that I wrote about First Street. It essentially tracks how the cost of insurance has become a larger proportion of the costs to individuals of owning a home. And as that happens, owning a home is becoming obviously more expensive, but also less profitable. So that gets at the appreciation of property question. And big picture, what that means is that it will become very expensive to own property. It will be expensive to insure it and to maintain it and to protect it and to rebuild it in that worst case scenario that it's damaged through a climate related disaster. And all of that is likely to change the picture of homeownership, which is why I suggest this, you know, sort of rethinking of the American dream, because at a minimum, it suggests that homes won't perform for us the way that they have economically. But at a maximum, it means that maybe a lot of people who could have afforded homes in the past will not be able to in the future. And so, you know, one possible outcome from that is that we all do rent our homes, our property, rather than owning them in the future, and some other entity actually owns that property. Maybe we invest or save our money in different ways going forward.
So if you live in an area of the country that's not as affected by climate change, your home will still be worth a lot of money, would you say? And you could benefit from selling it just the way you would in the past?
There's a lot of moving parts here, and it's really difficult to predict. The study that First Street released suggests that home values will decline across 85% of census tracts in the country. That's an enormous, overwhelming majority of parts of the country. So that suggests that, no place is perfectly safe, or few places are perfectly safe. Obviously, there's 15% left, and they could appreciate in those places. And that First Street report suggests that prices could increase by 10% in those beneficial areas. So I see those kinds of numbers and projections as imprecise. I would take them as, compass arrows pointing in a direction, but their specificity I would take with a grain of salt. I think that the big message is, that we're at a bit of an inflection point where values are undermined, and we have to start thinking about the possibility that real estate values will decline. My book focuses a lot on where people might move to and the parts of the country that are threatened, which is to overgeneralize, in the West and the South and the Sun Belt, and where people might move to, which is, again, to overgeneralize, is, the Great Lakes and the northern part of the country. And so no place is safe from climate change. Very cold, but getting warmer. No place is safe from climate change, but it's all relative. And I think the risk is relatively less in those potential destination places.
Is this a worldwide phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, climate change is a global phenomenon, and
effect on home ownership.
Well, I don't know that every part of the world uses home ownership the way Americans do to save assets, and certainly isn't priced the same way. I see the climate migration phenomenon as a global phenomenon. There will be incredible pressure from the mid-latitudes and the equatorial parts of the globe, towards the north in particular. And that'll have a lot of different effects depending on, what country you're in. For the United States, it means there's going to be migration pressures on our borders from outside the country. And then, that movement in the country northward. It is clear globally that climate change is going to change asset values and deeply undermine economies, no matter what country or what economy or what industry you're looking at. But I don't know if we can say that about, real estate in particular around the world.
That was ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about climate change and its potential to upend the American dream. You've been